This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Fever 1793 by Laurie Hulse Anderson. Narrated by Bailey Carr. Chapter 1. August 16, 1793. The city of Philadelphia is perhaps one of the wonders of the world. Lord Adam Gordon, Journal Entry, 1765. I woke to the sound of a mosquito whining in my left ear, and my mother screeching in the right.
"Rouse yourself this instant!"
Mother snapped open the shutters and heat poured into our bedchamber. The room above our coffee house was not large. Two beds, a washstand, and a wooden trunk with frayed leather straps nearly filled it. It seemed even smaller with Mother storming around.
"Get out of bed, Matilda," she continued. "You're sleeping the day away."
She shook my shoulder.
"Polly's late, and there's work to be done."
The noisy mosquito darted between us. I started to sweat under the thin blanket. It was going to be another hot August day. Another long, hot August day. Another long, hot, boring, wretched August day.
"I can't tell who is lazier, Polly or you,"
Mother muttered as she stalked out of the room.
"When I was a girl, we were up before the sun."
Her voice droned on and on as she clattered down the stairs. I groaned. Mother had been a perfect girl. Her family was wealthy then, but that didn't stop her from stitching entire quilts before breakfast, or spinning miles of wool before tea. It was the war, she liked to remind me. Children did what was asked of them, and she never complained. Oh, no, never. Good children were seen and not heard. How utterly unlike me. I yawned and stretched, then snuggled back onto my pillow. A few more minutes' rest, that's what I needed. I'd float back to sleep, drifting like Blanchard's giant yellow balloon. I could just see it. The winter's day, the crowds on the rooftops, the balloon tugging at its ropes. I held my breath. Would the ropes break? The devilish mosquito attacked, sinking its needle nose into my forehead.
Ow!
I leapt from my bed and, thunk, cracked my head on the sloped ceiling. The ceiling was lower than it used to be. Either that or I had grown another inch overnight. I sat back down, wide awake now. My noggin sporting two lumps, one from the ceiling, one from the mosquito. No balloon trips for me. To work, then. I got to my feet and crossed the room, ducking my head cautiously. The water in the wash basin was cloudy, and the face cloth smelled like old cheese. I decided to clean up later, perhaps next December. A squeaking mouse dashed by my toes, followed by a flash of orange fur named Silas. The mouse ran to a corner, its claws scratching desperately on the floorboards. Silas pounced. The squeaking stopped. "Oh, Silas, did you have to do that?" Silas didn't answer. He rarely did. Instead, he jumped up on Mother's quilt and prepared to pick apart his breakfast. Mother's best quilt. Mother abhorred mice. I sprang across the room.
"Get down!" I commanded.
Silas hissed at me but obeyed, leaping to the floor and patting out the door.
"Matilda!"
Mother's voice called up the stairs.
"Now!"
I made a face at the doorway. I had just saved her precious quilt from disaster, but would she appreciate it? Of course not. No more dawdling. I had to get dressed. I fastened my stays and a badly embroidered pocket over the white shift I slept in. Then I stepped into my blue linen skirt. It nearly showed my ankles. Along with the ceiling getting lower, my clothes were shrinking too. Once dressed, I faced the rather dead mouse and wrinkled my nose. Picking it up by the tail, I carried the corpse to the front window and leaned out. My city, Philadelphia, was wide awake. My heart beat faster, and my head cleared. Below the window, High Street teemed with horsemen, carriages, and carts. I could hear Mrs. Henning gossiping on her front stoop, and dogs barking at a pig running loose in the street. The sound of the blacksmith's hammer on his anvil reminded me of Polly, our tardy serving girl. That's where she was, no doubt, in the blacksmith's shop, eyeing Matthew, the blacksmith's son. I didn't like it there. The roaring furnace, sparks crackling in the air, the sizzle of hot metal into cold water. It all reminded me of that unmentionable place the preachers liked to go on about. My favorite place was the waterfront. I squinted eastward. The rooftop of the State House, where the Congress met, was visible, but the August haze and dust from the street made it impossible to see farther than that. On a clear day, I could see the masts of the ships tied up at the wharves on the Delaware River. I promised myself a secret visit to the docks later, as soon as Polly arrived to distract Mother. A few blocks south lay the Walnut Street prison, where Blanchard had flown that remarkable balloon. From the prison's courtyard it rose, a yellow silk bubble escaping the earth. I vowed to do that one day, slip free of the ropes that held me. Nathaniel Benson had heard me say it, but he did not laugh. He understood. Perhaps I would see him at the docks, sketching a ship or seagulls. It had been a long time since we talked. But before I went anywhere, there was a dead mouse to dispose of. I couldn't throw it into High Street. It might spook one of the horses. I crossed the room and opened the back window, overlooking the garden. Maybe Silas would smell his treat out there and get a decent breakfast after all. I flung the corpse as far as I could, then hurried downstairs before Mother boiled over. Chapter 2. August 16th, 1793. The first and most principal to be a perfect skill and knowledge in cookery, because it is a duty well belonging to women. Gervais Markham, The English Housewife, 1668. As soon as I stepped into the kitchen, Mother started her lecture.
"Too much sleep is bad for your health, Matilda."
She slipped a freshly made ball of butter into a stone crock.
"It must be a grip, a sleeping sickness."
I tried not to listen to her. I had not cleared the wax from my ears all summer, hoping it would soften her voice. It had not worked.
"You should be dosed with fish oil. When I was a girl..."
She kept talking to herself as she carried a steaming pot of water outside to rinse the butter churn. I sat down at the table. Our kitchen was larger than most, with an enormous hearth crowded with pots and kettles, and two bake ovens built into the brickwork beside it. The size of the room did not match the size of our family. We were only three, Mother, Grandfather, and me, plus Eliza, who worked for us. But the roomy kitchen could feed 100 people in a day. My family owned the Cook Coffee House. The soon-to-be-famous Cook Coffee House, Grandfather liked to say. My father had built our home and business after the War for Independence ended in 1783. I was 4 years old. The coffee house sat just off the corner of 7th and High Streets. At first, we were lucky if a lost farmer strayed in, but business improved when President Washington's house was built 2 blocks away. Father was a carpenter by trade, and he built us a sturdy home. The room where we served customers filled most of the first floor and had four large windows. The kitchen was tucked into the back, filled with useful shelves and built-in cupboards to store things. We could have used a sitting room, truth be told. Father would have added one on, if he had lived. But he fell off a ladder and died of a broken neck 2 months after the coffee house opened. That's when Grandfather joined us. A coffee house was a respectable business for a widow and her father-in-law to run. Mother refused to serve spirits, but she allowed card games and a small bit of gambling, as long as she didn't have to see it. By midday, the front room was usually crowded with gentlemen, merchants, and politicians, enjoying a cup of coffee, a bite to eat, and the news of the day. Father would have been proud. I wondered what he would have thought of me.
"Good morning," Eliza said loudly, startling me. "I thought you were going to sleep the day away. Have you eaten?"
She set a sack of coffee beans on the table. "I'm starving," I said, clutching my stomach.
"As usual," she said with a smile. "Let me get you something quick."
Eliza was the coffee house cook. Mother couldn't prepare a meal fit for pigs. I found this amusing, considering our last name was Cook. In a manner, though, it was serious. If not for Eliza's fine victuals and the hungry customers who paid to eat them, we'd have been in the streets long ago. Mother's family had washed their hands of her when she ran off to marry a carpenter, a tradesman, the horror, when she was but 17. So we were very fond of Eliza. Like most blacks in Philadelphia, Eliza was free. She said Philadelphia was the best city for freed slaves or freeborn Africans. The Quakers here didn't hold with slavery and tried hard to convince others that slavery was against God's will. Black people were treated different than white people. That was plain to see. But Eliza said nobody could tell her what to do or where to go, and no one would ever, ever beat her again. She had been born a slave near Williamsburg, Virginia. Her husband saved up his horseshoeing money and bought her freedom right after they were married. She told me that was the best day of her life. She moved to Philadelphia and cooked for us, saving her wages to set her husband free. When I was 8, she got a letter saying her husband had been killed by a runaway horse. That was her worst day. She didn't say a word for months. My father had only been dead 2 years, so Mother knew just what lay in Eliza's heart. They both supped sorrow with a big spoon, that's what Mother said. It took years, but the smile slowly returned to Eliza's face. She didn't turn sour like Mother did. Eliza was the luckiest person I knew. She got to walk from the river past shop windows, market stalls, and the courthouse up to 7th Street every morning. She told stories even better than Grandfather, and she knew how to keep a secret. She laughed once when I told her she was my best friend, but it was the truth. She dished up a bowl of oatmeal from a pot that hung by the side of the hearth, then carefully set it in front of me. "Eat up," she said. One corner of her mouth turned up just a bit, and she winked. I tasted the oatmeal. It was sweet. Eliza had hidden a sugar lump at the bottom of the bowl. "Thank you," I whispered. "You're welcome," she whispered back. "Why is Polly late?" I asked. "Have you seen her?" Eliza shook her head.
"Your mother is in a lather, I promise you," she warned. "If Polly doesn't get here soon, she may need to find herself another position."
"I bet she's dawdling by the forge," I said, watching Matthew work with his shirt collar open.
"Maybe she's ill," Eliza said. "There's talk of sickness by the river."
Mother strode into the room, carrying wood for the fire.
"Serving girls don't get sick," Mother said.
If she doesn't appear soon, you'll have to do her chores as well as your own, Matilda. And where is your grandfather? I sent him to inquire about a box of tea an hour ago. He should have returned by now.
I'd be happy to search for him, I offered. I could look for Polly, too. Mother added wood to the fire, poking the logs until the flames jumped. The delicate tip of her shoe tapped impatiently.
No, I'll go. If Father comes back, don't let him leave. And Matilda, see to the garden.
She quickly tied a bonnet under her chin and left, the back door closing behind her with the sharp sound of a musket shot.
Well, said Eliza, that's it, then. Here, have some veal and cornbread. Seems like you've a long day ahead of you.
After she cut me two slices of cold veal and a thick piece of fresh cornbread, Eliza started to make gingerbread, one of her specialties. Nutmeg and cinnamon perfumed the air as she ground the spices with a pestle. If not for the heat, I could have stayed in the kitchen for an eternity. The house was silent except for the popping of the applewood in the fire and the tall clock ticking in the front room. I took a sip from a half-filled mug on the table. Ugh, it's coffee. Black coffee, bitter as medicine. How can you drink this? I asked Eliza.
It tastes better if you don't steal it, she answered.
She took the cup from my hands.
Pour your own and leave mine be.
Are we out of cider? I asked. I could get some at the marketplace.
Oh, no, Eliza said. You'll stay right here. Your mother needs your help, and that poor garden is like to expire. It is time for you to haul some water, little Maddie.
Little Maddie, indeed. Another month, and I'd be almost as tall as Eliza. I hated to be called little. I sighed loudly, put my dishes in the washtub, and tucked my hair into my mob cap. I tied a disreputable straw hat atop the cap, one I could never wear in the street, and snatched a bite of dough from Eliza's bowl before I ran outside. The garden measured 50 paces up one side and 20 along the other, but after 6 weeks of drought, it seemed as long and wide as a city block, filled with thousands of drooping plants crying for help. I dropped the bucket into the well to fill it up with water, then turned the handle to bring it back up again. Little Maddie, indeed. I was big enough to be ordered around like an unpaid servant. Big enough for Mother to grumble about finding me a husband. I carried the water to the potato patch and poured it out too fast. Big enough to plan for the day when I would no longer live here. If I was going to work as hard as a mule, it might as well be for my own benefit. I was going to travel to France and bring back fabric and combs and jewelry that the ladies of Philadelphia would swoon over. And that was just for the dry goods store. I wanted to own an entire city block, a proper restaurant, an apothecary, maybe a school or a hatter's shop. Grandfather said I was a daughter of liberty, a real American girl. I could steer my own ship. No one would call me Little Maddie. They would call me Ma'am. Dash it all. I had watered a row of weeds. As I returned to the well, Mother came through the garden gate. "Where's Polly?" I asked as I dropped the bucket down the well. "Did you pass by the blacksmith's?"
"I spoke with her mother, with Mistress Logan,"
Mother answered softly, looking at her neat rows of carrots. "And?" I waved a mosquito away from my face.
"It happened quickly. Polly sewed by candlelight after dinner. Her mother repeated that over and over. She sewed by candlelight after dinner. And then she collapsed."
I released the handle and the bucket splashed, a distant sound.
"Matilda, Polly's dead."
Chapter 3. August 16th, 1793. Oh, then the hands of the pitiful mother prepared her child's body for the grave. Letter of Margaret Morris, Philadelphia, 1793.
Dead? Polly's dead? I couldn't have heard her properly. Polly Logan? The sweat on my neck turned to ice, and I shivered. Our Polly? That can't be. I tried to remember the last time we had played together. It was before she started working for us. Last Christmas. No, well before that. Her family had moved to Third Street at least 2 years ago. She had been a cradle friend, the girl I played dolls with. We sang nonsense songs together when we churned butter. I could see it then, my small hands and Polly's together on the handle of the churn. I took a deep breath and closed my eyes. Mother led me inside by the elbow, and I sat heavily on a chair. She quickly told Eliza what happened.
There was no doctor in attendance,
Mother explained.
She shook with fever briefly, 3/4 of an hour, cried out once, and died in her own bed. They don't know what it was. It could have been anything. There are so many fevers at summer's end,
Eliza said.
Is anyone else in the house sick? Sick with grief,
Mother said. She poured herself and Eliza each a mug of coffee.
It's a large family. She still has 7 children under 10 years, one a babe in her arms. We'll pray they don't take sick,
Eliza said as she took the mug.
Are any neighbors ill?
Mother blew in her cup and nodded.
An old man who lives across the alley is rumored to be sick in bed, but you know how these stories catch fire. It's strange, though. She was a healthy girl, robust. Never saw her so much as sneeze before.
I kept my eyes closed, trying to see Polly happy, joking, maybe stealing a kiss with Matthew, then bursting through the door to tell me. It couldn't be real. How could Polly be dead?
Matilda, are you well?
Asked Mother.
She looks peculiar, don't you think, Eliza? Are you feverish?
She laid her hand on my forehead. Her fingers were rough but cool and smelled faintly of lavender. I wanted to lay my head on her shoulder, but that would have been awkward. Mother slipped her hand to the back of my neck.
She did not suffer, Matilda. We must be grateful for that.
She removed her hand and peered into my eyes.
This heat is not healthy. You must tell me straight away if you feel peckish.
I waited for her to say something more about Polly. She did not.
We should send something along for the family, suggested Eliza. Her mother is in no condition to cook. Mattie could take a ham over. No,
Mother said quickly. She set the coffee mug on the table with a thump.
I don't want her near there, not with a sickness in the air. Besides, she hasn't played with Polly for years. The girl was our servant, not a friend.
Yes, she was, I protested. Let me go, please. I'll take some food. You know they need it. And I'll pay my respects to her mother. It's the proper thing to do.
I've already paid our respects, Mother said. You'll just upset her mother more. I'll take a food basket there myself, tomorrow. Now put on a clean apron, Matilda, and wash your hands. It's time to get to work.
I want to see her.
No.
What about the funeral?
I asked, blinking back the tears.
You must let me attend that.
No, absolutely not. I forbid it. You'll have nightmares.
She was my friend. You must allow me. Why are you so horrid?
As soon as the angry words were out of my mouth, I knew I had gone too far.
Matilda!
Mother rose from her chair.
You are forbidden to speak to me in that tone. Apologize at once.
The sun coming in the south window cast deep shadows under her eyes and cheekbones. She held her jaw tight, her eyes flashing with anger. She looked old, much older than she should. She hadn't always been so pinch-faced and harsh. When Mother allowed herself a still moment by the fire on winter nights, I could sometimes see the face she wore when Father was alive. Back then, Mother smiled at me with her eyes, and her laughter, and her gentle hands. But no longer. Life was a battle, and Mother a tired and bitter captain. The captain I had to obey.
My apologies,
I said.
Chapter 4, August 16th, 1793. Diet bread. 1 pound sugar, 9 eggs, beat for an hour. Add to 14 ounces flour, teaspoon rose water, 1 teaspoon cinnamon or coriander. Bake quick. Amelia Simmons, American Cookbook, 1796. By mid-afternoon, the front room of the coffee house was thick with customers, pipe smoke, and loud arguments. A ship's captain finished telling a yarn, and the window panes rattled with laughter. Mother poured him a cup of coffee with a steady hand. She looked up as I walked by carrying a tray of fresh gingerbread, but she wouldn't meet my eye.
"Over here, lass!"
Grandfather shouted from his corner seat. Above his head hung the cage of King George, the scraggly green parrot won in a card game.
"Bring those delectables over here and give us a kiss."
My grandfather was Captain William Farnsworth Cook of the Pennsylvania 5th Regiment. He was a stout man, thanks to Eliza's cooking, and the heart of all gossip and tall tales in the coffee house. He had been an army officer his whole life and was happiest when serving under General Washington. He tried to instill some military training in me, but always sweetened it with candy. I held the tray over my head as I squeezed past the crowded tables. Grandfather sat with 2 government officials, a lawyer, and Mr. Karras, who owned an export business. I set the tray in front of Grandfather, and he patted my hand.
"Look here, gentlemen, sweets offered by the sweetest filly in the Commonwealth. What will you have?"
"Can that be little Maddie?"
elderly Mr. Karras asked as he squinted through his bifocals.
"Why, she's grown into a fine young lady. Much too fine for this type of work. We'll have to find a husband for you."
"A husband! A husband!"
King George squawked. My face flushed as the men laughed. "Hush, you old thing," I muttered to the bird. It would have been rude to hush Mr. Karras. "I'll feed you to Silas if you don't close that beak." Grandfather gave the pest a piece of gingerbread, and Mr. Karras went back to his original subject.
"It's that heap of rotting coffee beans on Ball's Wharf, I tell you,"
Mr. Karras said to the other men.
"It's the source of a deadly miasma, a foul stench indeed. There are noxious fumes all around the district. Mark my words, it will be a killer yet."
Is that what killed Polly? A miasma? I could feel the tears stinging my eyes, but I couldn't escape, not with Grandfather holding my hand. I wanted to tell him what happened. He'd understand. But not in front of all these people. The lawyer shook his head in disagreement.
"It creates an awful stench, yes, but no one dies from a bad smell. If they did, every farmer spreading manure would be long dead, and us city dwellers all hungry."
Grandfather roared with laughter and slapped his knee.
"Hungry!"
echoed King George.
"Hold there, Marks! Hold there, I say!"
interjected the government clerk. His left eye blinked with a nervous twitch.
"I've heard stories of a fever among the Santo Domingan refugees. They live close to Ball's Wharf, you know."
A doctor at the next table looked up from his backgammon board and interrupted the conversation.
"It's not just the refugees," the doctor said.
"This morning I spoke with a colleague who was called to the Shewal home.
Mary Shewall died soon after of a bilious fever, and one could hardly fault her character. There may well be a disease in the air again. Yellow fever.
The room grew quiet as the entire company listened in.
A woman dies of some illness, and you talk of yellow fever?
The lawyer asked.
We haven't seen yellow fever in Philadelphia for 30 years. It is too early to tell,
the doctor agreed.
But I know of some who are sending their wives and children up to the country, to healthful air and cool breezes. You doctors are all alike, scaring us to earn more business. My family will stay right where they are, thank you,
the lawyer replied.
All the same, a trip to the country sounds refreshing,
Mr. Karras said. Grandfather thumped his boot on the floor.
Balderdash, bad coffee is a nuisance, but it won't kill anyone. Some poor soul dies of a fever every August. That's why my boy had the good sense to open this fine establishment so far away from the river, away from the smells, filth, and disease. Enough fever talk. Maddie girl, bring us more tea. And who will tell me why Mr. Jefferson wants to quit his job? Isn't being Secretary of State good enough for him, or does he want something more?
The men all shouted. They loved to argue about Mr. Jefferson. I fetched a fresh pot of coffee from the kitchen. Eliza and Mother didn't say a word to me. There was too much work to do. I poured coffee and tea, served oyster loaf and Indian pudding, carried the dirty dishes back to Eliza, and tried to keep the floor swept clean. I didn't have time to worry about fevers or husbands or rude parrots. Eventually, the hour struck, and the customers donned their hats and said their farewells. Mother called me to help figure the bills and exchange the many kinds of money. Pence from Massachusetts, shillings from Virginia, British pounds, and French francs. I double-checked the long column of numbers. Taking care of accounts was one territory that Mother conceded to me. If she added the fingers on one hand, she was just as likely to total 4 as 6. Grandfather left for his constitutional stroll around the city, but I was not allowed to join him. I had to take Polly's place in the kitchen, washing up, sweeping the floors, dusting the tables, and putting everything back in its proper place so we would be ready to do the same thing the next day. My arms felt as heavy as lead from carrying the trays. My shift was sticky with perspiration, and I smelled of tobacco smoke and unwashed strangers. How did Polly do this every day? I forced my eyes open to look at Mother putting away the clean china. "I'll help," I said.
"Don't be ridiculous," she answered. "You're exhausted. Polly will do it in the morning."
She stopped. The house was silent for a moment, except for the sound of Matthew down the block still hammering away at his forge. Had anyone told him that Polly was gone?
"I'll finish it," Mother corrected herself. "Go to bed. I need you up early to clean out the fireplace."
Chapter 5. August 24th, 1793. A low voice and soft address are the common indications of a well-bred woman. Hannah Moore, The Young Lady Abroad, or Affectionate Advice on the Social and Moral Habits of Females, 1777. A week later, 64 people had died, though no one seemed quite sure what killed them. Rumors of a fever near the docks snaked through the city. People avoided the shops by the river and came up to our end of High Street, where the air smelled cleaner. They made our strongbox grow delightfully heavy. There was little time to mourn for Polly. I slaved from dawn until the stars shone, house chores in the morning, serving coffee in the afternoon, and cleaning after supper. Sleep became more precious to me than food. One night I fell asleep in the necessary and woke with a fervent prayer of thanks that I had not fallen in. My first chance for escape came 8 days after Polly died, as Mother and Grandfather discussed their plans for the day.
"We need extra eggs, hard cheese, pippin apples, and savory, and lemons. I'll have to go to the market again," sighed Mother.
I concentrated on a hoe cake spread thick with honey.
"You're too tired, Lucille. Send the child to market,"
Grandfather suggested. I quickly swallowed the hoe cake.
"No, Matilda must stay home. I shall go."
Mother fanned herself with her hand.
"It is uncommonly warm, isn't it?"
I jumped to my feet. "Grandfather's right. You need the rest. Please let me go." Mother tapped her finger on the table. A good sign. She was thinking. Grandfather tried again.
"You've fussed for days because you don't like her serving customers. Let her run the market errands. It will clear her head. Young people need the outside air."
The fingers stopped. A bad sign.
"I was thinking of sending her to the country, to the Luddingtons at Gwynedd. You encourage her to go deeper into town."
Mother frowned. "The Luddingtons? The Luddingtons had a farm with disgusting pigs and dogs that bit. Any place would be better than the Luddingtons." Grandfather fed a cracker to King George.
"Must you be so gloomy, woman? You see darkness in every corner. Sending her away, your own child? You shock me. The Luddingtons aren't even family. I can't see the wisdom in that. We'll have to consider this at some length,"
he said, drawing out his pipe. The considering could take hours. The sun was growing hotter, and the larder stood empty.
"If I don't go soon, everything will be sold or spoiled," I reminded them. "People don't stop eating eggs whenever there's a fever, do they?" I had to get her attention away from that farm.
"The child's right, Lucille. She'll be fine. We must accommodate our lives to the fever for a few weeks, but we shan't overthrow our daily routines. It's important that we not lose our heads."
"But, Polly,"
Mother started.
"Whatever took that little imp away, it wasn't a fever. I promise you that,"
Grandfather said.
"It could have been a sudden pleurisy or a weak heart. You worry too much. Always have. The market is the safest place in town, next to our own castle here. Now let the child get some air."
Mother pursed her lips a moment, then nodded.
"I'll write a list for you."
"I know what we need," I quickly replied.
"Don't shop at any stalls below Third Street. Stay away from Second Street Market completely. And no rambles today. You go to the market, and then you come home. And do not let me hear of you loitering shamelessly in front of the Peel House."
I turned so she would not see me blush. Why did it matter if I walked past the Peels?
"I think we should buy extra bread at the Simmons Bakery. We're sure to run out again."
"Good idea, girl," said Grandfather. "See there, Lucille? The child minds the shop as well as you. You mustn't be so hard on her. Come here, Maddie. Give this old soldier a kiss."
I pecked his cheek, and he slipped a piece of hard candy into my hand. I dashed out the door before Mother could change her mind. As I crossed Fourth Street, the noise from the market splashed over me like a wave.
"Is your lily-white hot corn? Get your nice hot corn!
Fresh fish fit for the pan!
Raspberries! Blackberries! Pepper pot! All hot! Make it strong! Make it live long! Come buy my pepper pot!"
The market stalls stretched for 3 blocks in the center of the street. West Indian women stood by their pepper pot kettles, stirring fragrant stews, while the hot corn girls walked up and down the street. The distant call of the charcoal man's horn sounded at the far end of the market. Chickens clucked and geese honked, customers argued about the price of pears, and children ran everywhere. Eggs, pippins, savory. What else did she want? I thought. Cabbage, crab apples. I rolled the candy in my mouth. It had a piece of tobacco stuck to it from Grandfather's pocket. I spit it out and walked up to the egg sellers.
Hello, Miss Matilda Cook.
Good morning, Mrs. Epler. Mr. and Mrs. Epler were German farmers who brought their eggs and chickens to market 3 times a week. Mrs. Epler fluttered in her stall, her tiny black eyes looking this way and that, her chins flapping as she spoke. Mr. Epler was egg-shaped, narrow at the top and bottom, bulging in the middle. He never spoke. His wife leaned forward.
I was just telling Epler here that your people would be already gone. All the farmers talk of this fever.
She waved her arms, scaring the chickens in their wooden pens at her feet.
So much fever talk.
Don't you believe it? I asked.
Them that are sick should the church visit. City folk, sinners at the docks, they don't visit the church, and God gives them the fever. It is a sign from God. The Bible says, the soul that sinneth, it shall die.
Mr. Epler nodded his head solemnly.
Did you to church go last week, Miss Matilda Cook?
Mrs. Epler leaned her beak forward. Yes, ma'am. Mother never lets me stay home. Mrs. Epler's face broke into a wide grin.
She's a good woman, your mother. You go to church and you have no worries. How many eggs you want, Li Pin?
With the eggs carefully tucked in my basket, I moved on to Mr. Owens's stall. He wrung his hands and apologized for the sorry-looking cabbages.
We were lucky to get those, what with this drought and all, he said.
He was so discouraged about the cabbages, it was easy to talk his price down. He may have lowered it even further, but I felt sorry for him. He had more children on his farm than he could count on 2 hands. The extra money was just what I needed to buy a bag of hard candy, without tobacco specks. The next stall had fresh lemons. I scratched the peel and held one up to my nose. Paris would smell like a lemon peel, far away and wonderful. I bought a dozen and kept one in my hand as I shopped. There was no savory to be found, and the apples were small and knobbly. Mrs. Hotchkiss charged an outrageous price for a moldy cheese, but there were no other cheese sellers. I had to use all the hard candy money. I did not bid her good day. As I rounded the butcher's stall at the far end of the market, someone grabbed my basket and spun me around. I clenched my fists and whirled to face my assailant. Nathaniel Benson. My stomach flipped over like an egg in a skillet. I brushed my hands on my apron.
Little Maddie is come to market. Are you sure you haven't lost your way?
He teased. Nathaniel Benson. He looked much more a man and less a boy than he had a few months earlier. He had sprouted up over my head and grown broad in the chest. Stop. I cautioned myself. You shouldn't look at him as if he were a racehorse for sale. But his hair was a beautiful chestnut color. I often walked past the Peel's house, but rarely had the chance to speak with him. His work as a painter's assistant required long hours. He was known to stroll past the coffee house from time to time, but Mother kept me busy when he approached. He wasn't suitable, she said. Had no future, was a scamp, possibly even a scoundrel. Last New Year's Day, Nathaniel had rubbed snow in my face and chased me across the ice. I pushed him into a snowbank, and Mother sent me home in disgrace. The following week, he took me to watch Blanchard's balloon fly away. He thought it would be marvelous to visit Paris. Nathaniel Benson. I cleared my throat. Good afternoon, Nathaniel. Kindly return my basket.
Is that all you have to say? You disappoint me. I thought you would send me sailing into the horse trough, at least. I guess you respect my new position as a man of the world.
You are not a man of the world. You clean paintbrushes, though for the life of me I don't know why Mr. Peel bothers with you. And you will end up in that trough if you don't give me back my basket. I paused. Your shoe buckle is missing.
What?
I grabbed the basket as he looked down to inspect his shoe.
Very funny, he said.
Why are you here? I asked. Shouldn't you be working? He snatched an apple from my basket and took a bite. The impudence.
Master Peel gave me the day off. He has a committee meeting with the mayor and a visit with a banker. I ruin so much when he's present, he's afraid to let me work unsupervised. The day is mine, so I'm going fishing. Want to come?
Fishing. I hadn't been fishing in months. And I'd known Nathaniel since I was a baby, so I could roll my sleeves up above my elbows in his presence, as long as Mother didn't see me do it. He raised an eyebrow, and his eyes sparkled. Trout? He smiled, and I got a chill. When had he started smiling at me like that? Maybe I wouldn't roll up my sleeves. One had to be careful with elbows and boys. I would fish like a lady, with good posture and a demure manner. I could set the eggs in the stream so they wouldn't spoil. Bong, bong, bong. The bell at Christ Church tolled heavily.
"Why is that ringing?" asked Nathaniel. "It's not the hour."
Bong, bong, bong. A little boy sitting on the cobblestones covered his ears. The chattering marketplace voices hushed as the ringing continued. Every face turned toward the bell swaying in its tower.
"Another person dead," said the butcher.
He brought his cleaver down, slicing the mutton leg on his table into two pieces.
"The bell rings once for each year the person lived," he explained.
19, 20, 21, counted Nathaniel.
The bell stopped.
21 years old. Do you reckon it was a fever victim?
Don't you start carrying on about this fever, I warned. When Mother isn't hollering at me about something I've done wrong, she's moaning about the fever. I lowered my voice. Did you hear about Polly Logan? He nodded.
Hard to believe, isn't it? I recall you pummeled me once when I stole Polly's doll.
I remembered, too. She loved that doll. I turned away so he couldn't see my tears. Nathaniel put his hand on my shoulder.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make you cry.
His hand felt kind and warm. I miss her. I didn't even get to say goodbye. I wiped my eyes on my sleeve and cleared my throat again. Enough about that. We won't talk about it anymore.
Suit yourself.
Nathaniel stuck his hands in his pockets and stared at the cobblestones. I balanced the basket on my hip. Conversation started up around us as the last echo of the bell died. You won't catch anything, I said. Fish don't bite this time of day. Nathaniel grunted. He knew I was right.
Well,
he started. I must go, I interrupted. There is so much to do at the coffee house. Good luck with your paints. I curtsied awkwardly, stepping on my shift and nearly falling on my face. Nathaniel tipped his hat to me like a gentleman. I tried to walk away with my head held high. I could still feel the weight of his hand on my shoulder. Good luck with your paints? Did I really say that? What a ninny.
Chapter 6. August 30th, 1793. Directions to the housemaid. Always, when you sweep a room, throw a little wet sand all over it, and that will gather up all the flue and dust. Hannah Glass, The Art of Cookery, 1747. I'll never complain about a cold day again, I vowed after another week of unceasing heat. Grandfather watched from the shade as I cranked the wheel of the mangle. Do you remember how thick the river ice was on New Year's Day? Grandfather patted his pockets absent-mindedly. Silas crouched next to his chair, intently watching a quivering cherry branch.
I remember how many cords of firewood I carried, and how the washwater by my bed froze every night. No, thank you, madam. I'd rather a warm day than a cold one. My bones ache at the thought of another frost. Have you seen my pipe?
I threaded another wet tablecloth through the mangle to squeeze the water from it. The flagstones were cool beneath my feet, but the sun burned red as it mounted the sky. Another oppressively hot day. No, I haven't seen your pipe. And I adore winter. My favorite part was skating around the ships locked in solid by the ice. The Bensons were there, and the Peels, remember? It was delightful. Grandfather's white eyebrows crept skyward.
Speaking of Mr. Nathaniel Benson, he started.
Were we? I inquired.
Your mother heard that the young man was behaving improperly toward you at the market.
I let go of the mangle. It swung around and hit me in the leg. Ouch! No, I mean. Nathaniel was a gentleman. He expressed his condolences on the death of Polly Logan. Grandfather coughed once.
Better he should express himself into a better apprenticeship. He'll come of nothing dabbling in Peel's paint pots.
The tablecloth came out the other end of the mangle, and I dropped it into a hickory basket. I waved at the bugs hovering above my head. I do not wish to discuss Nathaniel Benson. That market is full of busybodies, I grumbled.
You are right about that. Let me help you, girl.
Grandfather rose stiffly. We each took a handle of the basket and carried it to the clothes horse, a rope strung between two wooden frames that we used for drying clothes and linens. Silas crept to the base of the cherry tree, tail twitching, head steady. Eliza came through the gate as we spread the tablecloth over the line to dry.
She certainly has you busy, Eliza chuckled.
All of us,
answered Grandfather.
Look there.
He pointed to two sacks by the back door.
She sent me to fetch those Arabica beans. Me, the hero of Trenton and Germantown, reduced to a simple errand boy. What has the world come to?
Father? Are you trying to kill us all?
My mother yelled from a kitchen window.
Your pipe is near to burn a hole in the table. And where are those coffee beans? We'll have customers soon.
Some days I'd rather face the British again than listen to the sound of my dear daughter-in-law,
Grandfather said.
Ho! Oh, look at that cat!
Silas's tail shot up like a warning flag. He had sighted the enemy, a squirrel. It scampered down the cherry's trunk and ran between Grandfather and Eliza. Silas leapt to the chase. They raced twice around the garden and under the mangle. The squirrel scrambled up the side of the necessary to the roof. Silas slowed for a heartbeat, then leapt to the fence to gain access to the roof and his furry meal. The squirrel jumped to the ground and dashed back across the yard, intent on his cherry tree.
Who wants to wager against the cat?
Asked Grandfather.
I say he'll have squirrel soup for his supper.
Silas closed in on the bushy tail. The squirrel lurched left and made a desperate leap up onto my clean laundry. Silas followed. The clothes horse collapsed under the weight of the stupid beast, sending angry cat and white linen into the red dust.
Hey!
I hollered. Silas yowled. Eliza and Grandfather burst into laughter.
Very droll, I said.
The midday meal was near over by the time I had rewashed the tablecloths. Cold chicken, crisp pickles, butter biscuits, and peach pie were laid out on the table. Mother and Grandfather were on their second mugs of apple cider when I finally sat down.
What do you think we should do with our extra earnings, Maddie?
Grandfather asked. I beg your pardon, sir.
Your grandfather has the foolish notion that we should go into trade, explained Mother.
open a regular store for the hordes of people who are going to settle at this end of the city any day now.
No need for a mocking tone, Lucille. We should use our windfall to improve our prospects. If it were up to you, we'd bury the money in the backyard to benefit the worms.
Mother pressed her lips together tightly and set a second piece of chicken on my plate.
Eat, she instructed. You've worked hard. I don't want you getting sick.
I pushed the chicken to the side. I had plenty of ideas about running the coffee house, all of them different from Mother's. First, we should buy another coffee urn to serve customers with more haste, I said. I pointed a pickle toward the north wall. Next is to expand into Mr. Watson's lot. That way we could offer proper meals, not just tidbits and rolls. You could serve roasts and mutton chops, and we could have an upstairs meeting room for the gentlemen, like the coffee houses by the wharves. I took a bite of the pickle. And we could reserve space to sell paintings and combs and fripperies from France.
Paintings? Fripperies?
Asked Grandfather.
There is no use talking of expansion, either of you, Mother said. Our custom improves because business by the docks declines. It's the talk of fever. People are afraid to venture out by the river.
Philadelphia suffers fevers every August, said Grandfather. This season it's those cursed refugees. They brought it, just as the ships from Barbados brought it 30 years ago. The mayor should quarantine them on Hog Island for a few weeks and the fever would pass.
He lifted his mug to King George. The parrot drank.
Must you encourage that creature? Mother asked. Perhaps we should leave, just until the weather breaks. Elizabeth Batchel's family left this morning.
I say we keep our heads and turn a tidy profit,
Grandfather continued.
Let others flee. We cooks are made of stronger stuff.
Be that as it may, the increased profits are temporary,
said Mother.
The fever will pass, and these new customers will go back to the wharves. If we do save some money, we'll keep it for a time when business lags.
I thought Grandfather was right. If we didn't open a shop or expand the coffee house, someone else would, and then it would be too late. Mother always planned for the darkest days. I took a bite of chicken. How much would Watson want for his lot? He spent most of his time in Baltimore. Perhaps Grandfather could inquire discreetly. Some chicken slid from my fork onto the floor. Dash it all, I said.
Dash it all! Dash it all!
Echoed King George. He swooped down for the treat and flew back to Grandfather's shoulder.
Matilda, your language,
Mother started. Her lecture was interrupted by a knock at the front door.
We're not yet open,
shouted Grandfather.
Come back in an hour's time.
A message, sir,
called a boy.
I'll tend to this matter, ladies,
Grandfather said grandly as he stood.
Don't bestir yourselves.
I ate quickly, with one eye on King George. Silas walked under the table, his tail still drooping from his defeat by the squirrel. I tempted him to my lap with his own bite of chicken. If I could convince Mother to buy an extra urn, it would quickly pay for itself. Then Eliza could cook real dinners with turtle soup and joints of beef and mutton. If we could get Mr. Jefferson to take his meals here, more business would follow. Maybe even the President himself and Mrs. Washington for tea.
Don't feed the cat at the table,
said Mother, tugging me back to earth. Silas keeps King George away from my plate, I said. Mother sighed.
I don't know which of you is worse.
Grandfather pulled a coin from his pocket for the messenger. He walked back slowly, rereading the thick sheet of paper in his hand.
What is that?
Asked Mother.
Nothing, a useless scrap. Nothing of interest for you.
A sly smile crept across his face.
If it's of no importance, then burn it,
Mother said. She stacked the dirty plates.
Why are you standing there like an addle-pated nitwit?
Grandfather looked at the paper again.
Oh, my,
he said with false surprise.
Is that Pernilla Ogilvie's name I see?
Mother set the pickle dish back on the table. Grandfather continued.
Pernilla Ogilvie. Isn't she the mother of that fine lad you pointed out to me in church? What was it?